Hello and welcome to this very special edition of Good Company, a collaboration between the Economic Club of Grand Rapids, the West Michigan Policy Forum, and the Grand Rapids Chamber. I'm Andy Johnston, Vice President of Government Affairs for the Grand Rapids Chamber, and I could not be more excited about what I've been asked to do today, and that is interview one of the most popular, thought-provoking authors, commentators, journalists, and podcasters on the planet, Stephen Dubner of Freakonomics. What you're about to hear is a podcast that was recorded just prior to Stephen Dubner's remarks to the Grand Rapids Economic Club on Monday, April 15th. Enjoy. Welcome to Grand Rapids, Stephen, and thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Freakonomics explores the hidden side of everything, from politics and the economy, to how to be happy and creative, to the future of meat, to how much LeBron James should get paid, and why mattress stores all cluster on the same street corners. What takes more time, selecting the topic or figuring out the right questions to ask?
So first of all, when I hear you say that list, that sounds dreadful. Like, what kind of crazy person does all that? I guess the trick or the appeal for me is when you recognize that you have a set of tools that can be applied to many topics, and not even just topics, but ideas, right? So ideas ranging from the way business gets done, let's say, and obviously economics has a lot to do with that, to ideas like interpersonal relationships, which is really, I mean, if you think about it, humankind's been around for a while now, and on most dimensions, we've gotten way better. You know, we don't have anywhere near as many wars. You know, we do a lot of things much, 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 much better than our ancestors did. But also, there are a lot of very basic things that we don't do very well still, including how people, you know, kind of think of themselves as part of society and individuals at the same time. So I just like to look for any sort of riddle or interesting area where some thinking that hasn't yet been applied can be applied, and come up with, if not necessarily answers, because I know most people, when they listen to a podcast or read a book or whatever, many people really want like the takeaway, like, what do I do now? What are the rules? What's the recipe for making this work or getting this moving forward? And I appreciate that, and I want the same thing too. But, you know, my view also is that most problems exist because they're hard. Easy problems get solved. They evaporate. The problems that are still around are hard. And therefore, if you can just make incremental improvement, even if only by learning to think about the problem in a little bit different way, that can be a contributor. So that's really what I try to look for.
And, you know, part of the appeal, too, is that some of the conclusions that you reach sometimes seem counterintuitive, you know, at first. One of those complex issues you just looked at was the issue of housing affordability, the recent podcast, Why Rent Control Doesn't Work. Very complex issue. What were some of your key takeaways from that episode on housing affordability and maybe how, you know, cities and regions and states and the nation can tackle it?
I think the biggest takeaway is an unfortunate one, which is that the political class and the kind of what I would call the noisy public are not by nature bad at coming up with viable long-term policy solutions, but short-term sloganeering is really more valuable for them. And therefore, and it's pretty successful. So, you know, I can run a campaign, whether I'm an advocacy group for something or other or a politician or whatnot. And, you know, those four or five powerful words, they can get a lot of attention, a lot of free media. You know, I think about free media a lot these days with 20-some candidates running for the Democratic presidential nomination. And people say, why do all these people run? Why do they not want to run? They're literally being handed tens of millions of dollars of free marketing, which, I mean, the one place in the world that you don't have to pay for marketing is if you're going to run for president. I should run for president, but I actually wouldn't want to be whatever. So I understand why the notion of rent control resonates for certain members of the political class and certain members of the public. But the fact is that, you know, economics are real. And if you say to a supplier of a product, in this case, you know, let's say living space or property, we're going to put a cap on or a series of restrictions on how you can recoup your investment, well, that's going to depress investment. That's just the way it works. So that's not to say that you shouldn't think really hard about how to make housing affordable in cities, because there is a paradox here. Cities are more popular than they've ever been. The more popular they get, the more expensive they tend to get. Mm-hmm. Therefore, do you want to exclude an entire, you know, socioeconomic class of people? I think we would all say the answer to that is no. So this is not a slam dunk. It's not an easy answer. But what we do know is in places that have had very strict versions of rent control or rent stabilization, one big side effect of that is that it contributes to undersupply, which drives prices up further, plus which a lot of rent control ends up being unfair because the people who get access to it are often people who play the system well. And so there's a lot of problems there.
So yeah, some short-term benefits, but the answers in the long term are really complex. You know, another issue that probably isn't at the forefront as much in people's minds is the issue of legacy costs, but it's, you know, definitely burdensome to cities, states, and the nation. I mean, just look around the country, there's these staggering debt costs. Have you explored that issue? Any takes on, you know, why isn't that get the kind of attention that maybe, you know, housing affordability does?
Yeah, it's remarkable. There was a piece in the Wall Street Journal last week based on a study by whom I can't recall, and it looked at the huge variance in different cities and states and how their pensions were underfunded, some cases unfunded, right. Some cases properly funded. I mean, this reminds me of, you know, in medicine now is in a much different place than it was 50 years ago. 50 years ago, if you were, let's say, a gastroenterologist who dealt with a lot of cancer, a lot of what you did was tell people, I'm sorry, we've detected cancer and you are going to die. Mm-hmm. There was very little at that point that could be done. Now we're at a point where there is better technology, there is better detection, et cetera. And so that problem over time is getting better. When I look at a problem like legacy costs generally, but particularly debt, that's been accrued over a series of either bad decisions or non-decisions over 40, 50 years, a lot of times the current administration is unfortunately in the position to say, I'm sorry, you've got a condition and you're going to die from it. Not that the city's going to die, but you can't undo that. You know, time is as massive and real a force as compound interest. So I think all you can do, I mean,
because that's a rough prognosis for the patient that you're saying here.
Yeah, it is. It absolutely is.
But so maybe cities and states that tackle it could be better positioned competitively for the future?
Yeah, and I think, you know, as with a lot of real problems, the first thing to do is not pretend the problem doesn't exist. Yeah. Then in cities and states, it almost immediately becomes a game of political gamesmanship where the current administration blames the past administration, even if that's totally warranted. And maybe there's some good to come out of that. I tend to think of this as a little bit like a household budget. Let's say I've got a budget of, you know, whatever, X thousand dollars, and all of a sudden I get hit with a bill that I wasn't expecting for one-tenth of X. It's going to be an annual surcharge. What do I do now? The first thing I have to do is I realize the way I'm spending my money right now has to change. And so I think that a lot of cities are put in a position where they've really only known one model, which mm-hmm. is to try to get more money from federal and state sources, to try to raise taxes and so on. Whereas, in fact, and economics can be somewhat helpful in this, there are better ways to create a tide that lifts all boats. There's more efficiencies, as we know. There's smarter taxes. There's more targeted taxes. You know, New York City, where I live now, we're instituting the first congestion charge in the United States, which on a lot of dimensions makes a lot of sense. Although I will say this, there's a new typical congestion charge going into place, which means that any vehicle that enters a certain area, I guess during a certain time of day, will be hit with a charge of, I don't know, $6, $10, $12, $15, right? But before that one gets invoked, there's actually a congestion surcharge, it's called, right?
Oh my
now
gosh.
That was just put on all taxis and car service rides of $2.50 or $2.75, which for the average ride in New York is probably like another 20% tax all of a sudden. That was just kind of laid on in a kind of, you know, dance of political convenience. And if you think about the effects of that, well, that money is supposed to now go to the repair of infrastructure that was largely ignored, mostly underground, mostly subways and some buses. At the expense of what? At the expense of hundreds of thousands of people who are making their living driving and getting around the city. So right there you see a case where, because of a pre-existing debt and problem, you have a new decision that's being made I'm not going to say it's going to just compound the original problem, but it is not the right smart kind of solution to it. So that's why, look, I'm a big believer in total transparency. I'm a big believer. And I think the biggest thing that governments and administrations generally can learn from economists is to be brutally honest and to acknowledge that there's no benefit without a cost. That's one thing that economists are really good at. You know, you can't say X issue is great and the opposite is terrible. There's always a cost to a benefit, and there's often a benefit when there exists a cost. And that's where I think I would like to hear politicians say, you know what, we're in a really bad condition right now because of X, Y, and Z. So we need to do something, and it might be quite drastic. And here's what we're trying to accomplish, and those will be good things, but we won't feel that effect for 2, 5, and 10 years. And in the interim, here are the bad things that are going to happen. And there's really nothing we can do about it if we want to have a city going forward. And those bad things mean we're going to have less of X or more of Y. And that is a kind of logic and transparency that I'd like to see happen a lot more in government and in the business community, honestly.
Yeah, it could apply to both, as you mentioned, infrastructure and legacy costs. Recognize that there's a problem so we can really start to tackle it and bring that new thinking that, you know, and the tools that you espouse through Freakonomics. One issue that is definitely on the forefront of everyone's minds is the talent gap or crisis. Talk to any business person across the country, it's a major issue. You've explored the issue from a bunch of different angles, early childhood being one. What's one or two thoughts on what business folks from West Michigan should be thinking about when we're trying to solve this talent gap?
Yeah, that's a great question. It's a really hard question because I think most people get and appreciate the ROI of education. The data are incredibly powerful in that direction. I mean, if you're going to invest $1 from the beginning of time in something for the largest return, what would it be? And a lot of people would say, you know, gold or rice or wheat or whatever. And probably it'd be education. You know, if you look at the gap between the populations that knew how to read and those that didn't over time, it's remarkable. So I think we know that. I think the problem is that, you know, this reminds me of any area where you've got a lot of technology and technology blends with kind of old-fashioned wisdom. I'll go back to medicine. Medicine's an area where the more technology there is, the easier it might be to not think about old-fashioned diagnostic skills, which are really, really tricky, really complicated. It's really hard to be good at that. So I think we tend to over-rely on obvious solutions that are put in front of us that may have some technical component and so on. And what I'm talking about here is, let's say, the education system. So it's very easy for all of us to say, you know, we wish collectively our population was more competent or better educated. Well, where is that coming from? The schools, the school system. What are the school systems doing wrong? So then there's a litany of complaints about that. Teachers aren't good enough. Curriculum isn't strict enough. Technology isn't, you know, omnipresent enough, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. The degrees to which all of those may or may not be true, that's a topic worth exploring. But I think a big question is also like, well, what are the schools, what kind of raw material are the schools getting and how strong are the incentives for the families to learn? In other words, I need a license, a state license. I don't know about Michigan, but in New York, I need a state license to cut hair, even if it's a dog's hair.
Same here in Michigan, right? Hopefully, okay. Not for much longer. But
okay.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of licensing for a lot of things, but it astonishes me that one of the few really major things anyone can do without a license is have a kid. So that always struck me as kind of strange. Now, I'm not advocating for that per se. I think it's potentially very problematic to say that. But it is very, very strange that, like, you know, we are very comfortable telling parents that when you have a kid, you do have to do X, Y, and Z, vaccination and so on and so on, which is controversial right now. But there is this, I feel, a little bit of a mismatch between the idea of expecting the schools or the education system to turn any human being into a really well-rounded, educated, caring individual. I think that having some kind of conversation about the role of family, parents, community, et cetera, in the overall education of children is hugely overdue. That's what I would say. And so I think that the more we silo it into well, that's the responsibility of the public education system, mm-hmm. or that's the responsibility of XYZ. I think that's a short-sighted way of looking at the world.
Right, because strong communities, you know, from a variety of different civic institutions, organizations, schools, they create that strong community that's going to, you know, turn out the kind of folks and the kind of outcomes that we want ultimately.
And parents. I mean, you know,
that's part of it.
My Freakonomics co-author, Steve Levitt, who teaches at the University of Chicago, he's done a lot of work with a number of other people looking at, for instance, heavy investment in basically educating parents to be more involved parents on an education level. So like parent academy type things.
Another great episode of Freakonomics. Definitely encourage people to look at that. Stephen, just one more quick question. You interview celebrities, titans of industry, researchers on the forefront of their topics. Do you have one favorite standard question that you like to ask your guests?
I do. It's interesting, yes, because I do have it. So usually, every interview is usually very custom made, meaning when we agree that we're going to interview someone, we do a lot of research and we maybe communicate with them or their people to see what they're working on, then we do a bunch more research and we come up with, you know, then we do a lot of reading and come up with questions that we feel will give the listener an insight that's not so typical, at least. But then we do have a standby list of about 30 questions.
Yeah, what's your favorite?
So my favorite, although this wasn't the favorite in the beginning, it was the favorite because every time we asked it, it got a really good answer, was tell me something that you believe to be true for a long time until you found out you were wrong, which is basically a way of saying, you know, tell me a story about changing your mind. And what's really interesting about it is the things that people say they used to believe and then change their mind on, usually those are not per se that interesting. They might be, but it's kind of binary. I used to think that, you know, something went this direction, then I came to believe it didn't. But hearing people talk about changing their mind, which is such a difficult thing, was so inspiring that we're actually working on an episode right now that'll be out pretty soon about the science of changing your mind and why most people are so averse to it in any. So I think it's actually great practice for people to just change your mind on like meaningless things. You know, if you're a Tigers fan, just for a year,
sounds really dangerous.
Yeah, that is dangerous. Don't get into it with sports maybe. But I feel like if you can learn to change your mind about small things, because there's research, for instance, that shows that most people by the time they're 35 will almost never eat any new kinds of food, listen to any new kinds of music, go any new place. It's like, yeah, I got it figured out. This is what I am. This is what I like.
So try something new. Start
practice
small.
Practice small.
And it'll lead to big things. I think we might ask you the same question on the Economic Club stage here in a minute, and we got to get you there. So that does it for us, Stephen. But thanks again for spending time with us today.
My pleasure. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Thank you for listening to this podcast collaboration between the Economic Club of Grand Rapids, the West Michigan Policy Forum, and the Grand Rapids Chamber. You're invited to engage in all three organizations. Trust me, there's something for you in each one of them. It's a great way to enrich yourself and our community. Have a good one.
You've been listening to Good Company, a product of the Grand Rapids Chamber of Commerce, where we have had extraordinary conversations with the hidden gems of the Grand Rapids community. That's a wrap, folks.